Hysteria is brought to you by Article. Article makes it effortless to create a stylish, long-lasting home at an unbeatable price. We love our Article. Erin loves her Article. Erin's got her outdoor furniture, which we've talked about all the time. I have some end tables. I have some little pieces of furniture in my bedroom. They were so easy to put together. They came, the shipping was seamless. And as of today, they've lasted for quite a few years. We are so grateful to have Article as a sponsor. Article offers a curated range of mid-century, modern, coastal, and Scandi-inspired pieces that not only shine on their own, but also pair seamlessly with nearly any other Article product. This thoughtful design approach makes it incredibly easy to mix and match, helping you create spaces that feel cohesive and stylish. Article takes great care in curating its collection, focusing solely on high-quality, meaningful pieces that will stand the test of time. There's no filler. Every item is chosen for its craftsmanship, design, and lasting value. You can immediately tell the difference in quality when you receive an Article piece. First of all, like I said, it's delivered. It's beautiful. Barely anything that you have to do. And when you put it next to things you've maybe bought at other stores, it just looks elevated. Always. For example, Article has smooth edges, secure joints, sturdy hardware, and it's fast and affordable. Article offers shipping across the US and Canada with options for professional assembly if you prefer a hands-off experience. I do enjoy that when I need it. Have a question or need help with your design choices? Article's customer care team is available 7 days a week, offering knowledgeable support and even free interior design services to help you get your home just right. With Article's 30-day satisfaction guarantee, you can shop with confidence, knowing that if you're not completely in love with your new furniture, you can easily return it. This peace of mind ensures you can invest in your home without hesitation. Article is offering listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/hysteria, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/hysteria for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And I'm Mallory McMorrow, who's not Erin Ryan.
That's right. Today we have Michigan State Senator and newly minted author Mallory McMorrow here filling in for Erin Ryan. I have a question, Mallory. Who is the scariest person you've ever accidentally included in a group chat?
Probably my mom. Oh my goodness. It's always...
That's my answer too.
When your mom is accidentally in the group chat and she doesn't know how to use it. Oh.
Or
terrible.
It was about her.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so funny. I think that other people in Washington, D.C. have different kind of scary people in their group chats these days. But I guess for us, it's our moms.
It's our moms. We're not any national security details.
No, not us. We're just simple ladies. Today, Mallory and I dive into Trump's systematic dismantling of the Department of Education, Lisa Murkowski's scathing read of the Republican Party, and our unhealthy news diet. Then Monica Lewinsky joins to talk about her new podcast and our love of Baskin-Robbins. Then Sani Petty. Okay, let's get to it. Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast that thinks picking up a book is good and so is reading it. Last week, Trump announced his long-anticipated plan to dismantle the Department of Education by signing an executive order that directed Linda McMahon to take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the department. When he signed the order, he said, "We want to return our students to the states." This is misleading because states are already in charge of setting students' curriculum and learning benchmarks. The Department of Education's primary role is to distribute money to schools, enforce civil rights laws, collect data on student performance, and run the federal student aid program for college students. He claimed that these duties will be redistributed to various other agencies and departments that will take very good care of them. The next day, he announced that the Small Business Administration would take over the government's $1.6 trillion student loan portfolio and that Health and Human Services would oversee nutrition programs and special education services. But the president can't just axe the whole department with a swipe of his fat pen. The department was created by Congress back in 1979, and it'll take an act of Congress to dismantle it. A federal lawsuit has already been filed in Massachusetts by the American Federation of Teachers, the American Association of University Professors, and a pair of public school districts in Massachusetts, and the plaintiffs asked a judge to immediately block the administration's interim campaign. Okay, So we know this. We know that he can't really just eliminate the Department of Education, but he can functionally neuter it to the point that it serves almost no purpose. So, Mallory, on the federal level, what does losing the DOE mean?
So I think a lot of people have a misconception about what DOE does on the federal level, particularly because Republicans and Donald Trump have told you that it is all about indoctrinating students. First of all, the DOE has nothing to do with curriculum, but it has a lot to do with funding. The Pell Grant is administered by the Department of Education. School Meals Program is administered by the Department of Education. If your child has an IEP, if you have a child with disabilities or special needs, that is all administered and protected through the DOE. And for a state like Michigan, we would stand to lose $2 billion in federal funding if DOE were to go away. And that would just mean we would have to backfill as a state. States, unlike the federal government, we can't run a deficit. So we've got about $2.7 billion in our state rainy day fund. It's the highest it's ever been. If we have to backfill, that wipes that fund out just for 1 year. And that doesn't account for losing all of that programming moving forward.
Our states, so everything they're talking about, they're like, we're going to send it back to the states. It's all going back to the states, administering all of this. Are states actually equipped to handle this?
No. In full, especially not in one fell swoop. It's one thing to say we're going to transition some of these roles and some of these responsibilities to either other federal departments or to the states. But the way that they're doing this, which is just taking a chainsaw like Elon Musk and slashing and burning through these departments, means that states are on their heels. We are not prepared to administer these programs in the state without a runway, without a plan in place. And I think that's the biggest thing that people need to worry about. There is no plan. And it means states are just scrambling to figure out what to do and how to appropriate our own budgets when we have no idea what is happening on the federal level.
Okay, so Project 2025. You're kind of the queen of Project 2025. You carried it around at the convention, spoke beautifully about how horrible Project 2025 is. During his campaign, Trump claimed to be unaffiliated with it. We know that's, we knew it then that it was not true. We know now because the architect of Project 2025 runs the Office of Management and Budget, so hard to have any plausible deniability there. Now, we know Project 2025 included 23 objectives related to the Department of Education. Half of them have already been achieved through executive action. Some of those are breaking up the Department of Education, cease investigating Title VI disparate impact cases, roll back student loan forgiveness, rescind Biden-era Title IX rules that strengthen the prosecution of sexual assault and discrimination claims, ban, quote, critical race theory and gender ideology from public school curriculum. I mean, it goes on and on and on. In your book, you shared an anecdote from your campaign that the same that I thought was so interesting, where when asked, when people are asked, when constituents out in the wild are asked, how do they feel about public education? They're highly dissatisfied. But when you ask them about the school their children attend, they tend to love it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, Republicans have been so successful at demonizing public education. And to put this into context, Michigan is the state that unleashed Betsy DeVos on the rest of the country.
Right.
So making it her mission to privatize education, to push these voucher schemes. So for decades now, they have been relentlessly messaging that public schooling is fundamentally broken, that teachers' unions have too much power, that there's corruption, that they are wasteful and they're full of fraud. So I would go door to door and I would hear this refrain that the schools are too bloated, there are too many levels, the teachers' unions are so corrupt and there's bad teachers that are kept in place. But then I would ask, well, tell me about your kid's school. It, like, Alyssa, 180 degrees immediately.
Yeah.
And people are like, well, no, 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 not my kid's teacher. She is wonderful. And she does all of these activities for the kids. And she's such a great reader. And she's inspired my son. And there's this disparate impact as if people feel like they're the exception and mm-hmm. everybody else is suffering. So they have to push so that everybody else has what they have. But I heard this over and over and over again. So, you know, I think there's a lesson here for Democrats and for people who care about all of this is don't speak in abstracts. People sure. can't wrap their head around the DOE and the administration and the unions, but talk about people's kids, teachers, talk about their schools because they love their schools by and large.
Right. That's do you think that it is too much listening to cable news? What creates this otherness of the school when it's not your school?
I think it's cable news. It's local yeah. news. It's podcasts. You know, you just hear this message over and over and over again. And I think about messaging and strategy all the time. Republicans are very good at
yeah.
picking a message and sticking to it and repeating it until it is so ingrained in your head that you may not even remember where you heard it, but it becomes not just an opinion. It's a fundamental truth that education is broken, mm-hmm. but you're the only exception and you're on this little island where everything is great. And that's really scary and something that we have to figure out how to break through.
So the other day, Dana Bash interviewed Linda McMahon, Secretary of Education, so it would be, and McMahon contradicted herself over and over again. One thing she kept doing, she was touting the benefits of, quote, no strings attached funding. Mallory, what are the consequences of no strings attached funding?
I love when they come up with different flowery names for vouchers. I mean, this is just what it is. This idea that they'll call it things like the dollars should follow the child. It would starve public schools to the point that they no longer exist. I mean, it's exactly what they're trying to do to these state departments right now, where they're not eliminating them, but they're going to starve them of all of their resources and all of their staff to the point that they no longer exist and can't function. Betsy DeVos has been pushing this in Michigan, in a state where it is written into our state constitution that no public funds can go to private or parochial schools. It's unconstitutional. That doesn't mean she's not trying.
Right.
And it would just allow somebody like Betsy DeVos, who does fund a lot of private schools, to get another yacht, to get another tax break when she doesn't need it. It didn't used to be controversial, and it shouldn't be controversial in this country, that education is a public good. We are stronger as a country when all of our children have access to great schools, when they get a great education, because that is our future workforce. So
right.
even if your child may do better in another school, if you can afford to send them there, great. But that does not mean that it should be at the expense of great public schools that benefit all of us.
Okay. That, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. Okay, Mallory, since the inauguration, we've been following the stories of politicians, mostly women, who have dared to stand up to Trump and the consequences they have faced for their actions. Last week, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska held a press conference in Juneau where she called out the Trump administration's mass firings, funding freezes, and bending to Elon Musk. She criticized her fellow Republicans for their spineless allegiance to the party or their caucus and even said she's considering re-registering as an independent. Murkowski knows that speaking out against Trump and Musk will lead her to a costly primary in 2028, but it's a risk she's willing to take. She said, quote, "I'm not going to compromise my own integrity by hiding from my words when I feel they need to be spoken. And it may be that Elon Musk has decided he's going to take the next $1 billion that he makes off of Starlink and put it directly against Lisa Murkowski." The Trump versus Maine saga also still ongoing. To catch listeners up to speed, last month, Trump singled out the governor of Maine, Janet Mills, for allowing trans athletes to play sports in Maine, and the governor shot back, saying that her state is following all federal and NCAA policies. This didn't stop Trump from continuing to threaten the state with funding freezes, investigations, and public callouts. Most recently, he took to Truth Social to say he will continue to target Maine unless he receives a full-throated personal apology from Mills and a commitment that she will never challenge the federal government again. Okay, Mallory. So also in this time frame, Mayor Muriel Bowser of Washington, D.C. took a different approach when she was facing threats from Republicans and chose to pick her battles in order not to jeopardize her city's funding, which ultimately then also came under attack. What are the merits of Mayor Bowser's approach versus Governor Mills?
So, you know, for any of the women in these roles, you got to put your constituents and your people first.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump is a child. the goalpost is going to keep changing. But I think the decision-making has to be do no harm for your constituents, because it's not just an attack on the senator or the governor or the mayor. It's an attack on all of the residents. If you're cutting funding, if you are carrying out these acts of retribution, it hurts your constituents. So I think that's the thought process you have to go through, is what is a fight worth fighting? What do we have to stand up for? Knowing that he's going to keep going. He's going to keep finding another reason to seek retribution and payback. But that's got to be the thought process, is this worth standing up, knowing that part of this administration's strategy is just to be relentless. There's going to be another attack. There's going to be another reason. There's going to be another thing. But you can't have your people caught in the crossfire.
So you had mentioned to me that some people in your state legislature are trying to out-Trump Trump. What does that look like in Michigan?
So in Michigan, Republicans took control of the state house in the last election. So we lost our Democratic trifecta. So now we're in divided government. I am in the state Senate, which is still controlled by Democrats. Matt Hall is the new Speaker of the House. And I know we talked about DOE. So we talked about what happens if the DOE gets cut. Republicans went and introduced a budget that would cut $5 billion from our state education fund. That is 25% of education funding across the state. And they tried to do it and frame it as a government shutdown prevention tool.
What?
It is still March, right? We're in March.
Yeah.
The budget is due in Michigan October 1st. So they are telling on themselves that we don't intend to actually complete a budget. They pass this through and they're trying to blame Democrats for wanting to shut down the government. And then Matt Hall goes and does these hour-long press conferences. I'm convinced there's nobody else in the room. He's standing in a room by himself with a podium, calling on fake people and rambling for an hour. So they're
it's
bonkers, but it's just like, I call him Timu Trump. It's just the knockoff version that you're getting online. But it hurts people, and people are livid. I think something that we've noticed on the ground is people don't really know what's happening in state government usually, because that's not what's on national news. It's not what's in the Washington Post or the New York Times or all over social media. But because they are doing exactly what Trump is doing, now people are aware. So they're coming out to our town halls and our coffee hours, and they know that education is being gutted because they see the federal government doing it. And now they also know that the state government is doing it, and the Republicans are doing it, and they're demanding to know what we're doing to fight back.
Oh boy. I'm just curious, in your career, what has bipartisanship looked like? Have you accomplished things through bipartisanship? Are there members of the Republican Party that actually still want to work with you and get things done?
Yeah, there are. You know, it doesn't get the headlines. In my first 4 years in office, I was in the minority. We had Governor Gretchen Whitmer. By necessity, the only ways that we were going to get bills to her desk was with Republican sponsorship and Republican support. I am the chair of the Senate Economic and Community Development Committee. So when it comes to small business support and entrepreneurship and how we are creating jobs in Michigan, I've got 6 or 7 Republicans on the other side of the aisle in a chamber of 38, who I've got a great working relationship with. So there is some hope. There's some silver lining, but it's on all those wedge issues and Matt Hall trying to model himself as baby Trump that may derail our ability to actually work together. And that's shameful. I didn't realize until recently he actually introduced this budget, and he went and gave one of these conferences and he said, Mallory McMorrow wants to shut the government down. I'm like, what are you talking about? I gave an interview back in October.
Wow.
Locally, where I was asked by a reporter, do you think we're going to see obstruction like we see in Washington if Democrats lose the state house? And I said at the time, my fear is that the Matt Hall version of the Republican Party is not Mitt Romney's Republican Party.
Right.
I represent Mitt Romney's hometown. But it is this Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump obstruction style brand of politics. And I warned that we could see a government shutdown because we had seen Republicans voting against the budget and Republicans voting against their own bills in ways that we hadn't seen it. And because I said that, apparently it's been living rent-free in his head for months. So now this whole thing and this budget that guts 25% of education funding is because I said he might shut down the government, which is crazy.
Do you think perhaps that you are living rent-free in his brain because he, like so many of us, saw that Mayor Pete is not running for Senate in Michigan and everyone's encouraging you to do so?
Oh, you know what? I certainly think that that is a likely possibility.
I mean, and I'm just saying, if you do decide to do something, I hope you'll come back and tell us more about it. Not pressuring you now, because in due time, but...
in due time. It's a big decision to make.
It's a big statement.
Yeah.
Just know, we here at Hysteria are Team Mallory. one last thing in this segment of news. Food banks across the country learned last week that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is canceling $500 million in expected food deliveries at a time when many Americans need the aid the most. So listeners, if you can, check out your local food bank and see if there is a way that you can help. A lot of them are online. I know that I follow my local food bank on Instagram, and I can see when the fridges are not full, and you can go down and bring what you have. Just always check and make sure it's not expired and something you would actually yourself want to eat. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hysteria is brought to you by Armour Colostrum. Everyone's looking for ways to be healthier and stave off winter illnesses. Give your immunity and gut health their best chance with Armour Colostrum. Discover the transformational health benefits of Armour Colostrum that have earned tens of thousands of five-star reviews. Probiotics and other supplements are touted as a gut health solution, but most products on the market are dead before they even reach your gut. Armour Colostrum naturally fortifies your entire gut wall system and optimizes your whole body microbiome, which helps guard against irritants that can trigger digestive issues and compromise your immune system. Research has shown that colostrum helps to enhance nutrient absorption. Armour Colostrum can help stabilize blood sugar levels, modulate hormones, and ignite your metabolism. This enhanced nutrient absorption has been a long-prized benefit of elite athletes. Let Armour Colostrum help you reach your goals by promoting lean muscle building and fueling cellular repair regeneration to fuel better performance and faster recovery. Colostrum Bioactives has also been shown to reactivate hair follicle stem cells and activate collagen production, promoting hair growth and enhancing skin radiance. We've worked out a special offer for our audience. Receive 15% off your first order. Go to tryarmra.com/hysteria or enter hysteria to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmra.com/hysteria.
For a limited time, you can get a Big Mac meal for just $8. That's a burger, fries, and a drink. They don't call it an extra value meal for nothing. Get a Big Mac meal only at McDonald's.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast that's really trying hard not to look at their phone first thing in the morning. Mallory, your book, Hate Won't Win, Find Your Power and Leave This Place Better Than You Found, came out this week, which I have already devoured, as you know. So many dog-eared pages, so many post-it notes. Let's talk about your experience writing it and dive a little bit into my favorite chapter. So first, when did you know it was time to write a book?
So I got to travel the country in 2022. I had a little bit of a weird 22. A colleague in Michigan accused me of wanting to groom and sexualize kindergartners and wanting eight-year-olds to believe they were responsible for slavery because these are the times that we live in.
Wow.
So I gave a speech that went a little bit viral, and I opened a pack and I traveled the country, and we were fundraising to flip the state Senate in Michigan for the first time since 1984. We ended up being successful, so hate didn't win. but throughout that process, I was in over a dozen different states, red states, blue states, people who are into politics, people who are not into politics. I talked to thousands of people, and overwhelmingly, I heard people say, I know I have to do something, but I'm so overwhelmed, I don't know what to do, and I don't know where to start. So that is what this book is. It is half a memoir about my very unplanned and unexpected journey into politics. I quite literally Googled how to run for office after the 2016 election, what I've learned, the hurdles that we faced, and then part two is a very practical how-to guide for anybody and everybody to find their own motivation, find their voice, learn how to tell a compelling story, and how to engage successfully with government at every level to get the change that we want to see and take our country back.
See, when I was writing my first book, I started writing it when I 100% thought Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016, and it went to publish after Donald Trump had won. So we actually had to go back in and tinker with it a little bit because it was going to be a little tone deaf, I think, if it came out the way I had actually finished writing it. So, but similarly, you have written this book in like fairly tumultuous times. What was it like writing during just such a pivotal time in American politics?
So I was in a similar boat, actually. I wrote this largely between 2023 and 2024. Every morning from 4 to 7 a.m., I would wake up before my daughter and I would sit down and get a cup of coffee and hammer away. So I had no idea how the election was going to turn out.
Sure.
I had hoped that this would be a book about how we all keep working together. But it's eerily prescient for this moment because it starts right after the 2016 election and my journey from there. I'm glad that it's out. I am really proud of what it says. But it was that very similar experience of looking at it and going, oh, crap, we actually really need this book and we need it now in a way that I had no idea when I was writing it.
And the funny thing is now having read your book, it's so evergreen. You know, it feels like the state of politics will be like that all of the very sage advice you give is going to be relevant for like many, many years to come. Something else that I really loved about your book is the marriage between your amazing personal story and the tangible advice that the reader can take away. And if it's okay with you, I would love to give the listener a preview into the tips you offered in your Find Yourself chapter of the book, which I even took notes, which were not for this interview. I did not think. I thought it was just for me. So starting off, can you tell me why this chapter was important for you to include in the book?
So right now, and I've done a few events for the book, one in Royal Oak and one in Ann Arbor, and I ask everybody in the audience by a show of hands who is overwhelmed right now. And inevitably, every single hand goes up. And so many people, I think, see all of the horrible things that are happening that are coming out of this administration and understandably want to do whatever they can to stop it. But if you do that and you're responding to every single thing that comes at us, you're going to get burned out so quickly. So the first chapter is find yourself. You have to understand who you are, what your motivation is, what you really care about. And I advise people to pick just one thing. One issue, one topic that is going to cause you to get up every morning and say, well, maybe I'm going to make one phone call or I'm going to send one email or I'm going to look up when this advocacy group is meeting and give yourself permission not to completely check out of everything else, but trusting that if everybody does this, then we're going to be okay. Then we'll have the coverage that we need. Mm-hmm. But that's the only way you're going to be able to sustain engagement so that civic engagement is not an action, it's a relationship that you're constantly checking in and being engaged. And I think that's a really important step that people just take the time to think about and process before you're just responding to everything that's coming at us. Because that's the strategy of this administration is that it is a fire hose. It is designed to overwhelm you so that you shut down. And knowing that, you got to stop and check yourself and figure out who you are and what drives you.
That is so true. Another theme in this chapter is taking back control over the time that digital technology is trying to monopolize. So explain to listeners your idea of a news diet and how they can be intentional with theirs.
It is a crazy time to be alive. We all carry around, you know, these phones in our pockets. And I am probably part of the last generation that existed in a time before the internet and iPhones were attached to us 24/7.
Yeah, I got my first email. I still have my first email address,
which
I got in 1997, I think.
Amazing. Yeah. So I write in the book, like, we got our first gateway PC and it was massive and it had a tower, you know, and we had to get a whole furniture set just for their computer and it lived in one section of our house. So the internet was still a place that you physically like had to go to and spend a little bit of time there. And then you left and my brothers and I had to take turns and my mom had to take turns. So, you know, we weren't
because you weren't getting phone calls to the house when you were on the computer because you were using the phone to dial up your internet.
Oh, yeah. Trying to explain that to my daughter one day. Like you pick up the phone and you're trying to download something from Napster and it totally disrupted it is going to be a conversation she's not going to understand. But, you know, what I write about in the book is the rest of the time that you weren't online, you were in the world. You were in your community. You were with your friends. You were with your neighbors. And you weren't constantly getting bombarded with notifications and updates and news about everything that's happening all the time. So now, whether it's news sites or social media, your phone is constantly binging and buzzing and telling you what's going on. And I just believe, you know, we were not designed to take in this amount of information at the pace that we take it on. It never ends. And social media is designed to keep you engaged as long as possible so that you watch their ads and so that they make money. So knowing that, how do you make sure you have control over digital media and social media and news, and it's not controlling you? So I am a huge fan of newspapers. I physically love newspapers that come to my house. And I advise in the book, you know, I show what I do. So I have subscriptions to the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News and my local newspaper, the Royal Oak Tribune. And when they come to my house, I feel satisfied knowing that if I did nothing but just read those, I would be sufficiently well informed about what is happening in the world and in the country and in my state and in my local community. And I could turn everything else off. So with that, you know, taking a step back and assessing how are you getting your information and where, turning off notifications on your phone, I advise going on a full digital detox. Shut it down for a few days and just see how you feel. Are you less anxious? What are you doing in your free time? Because how many of us haven't put this thing down in years? When's the last time we were actually really disconnected?
Well, and you talk in the book that when you did try a digital detox, your skin was itching, that you were like, you could feel it.
Yeah, and it wasn't intentional. It was accidental. I traveled with friends to Nicaragua, and there was no Wi-Fi. There was no connection. So, you know, this thing became useless. But it took, you know, I felt it in my body that I was literally crawling out of my skin thinking I was missing something. And it took 2 or 3 days to actually really settle in. And then I found myself writing again and drawing and, you know, just walking around and thinking clearly what I realized for the first time in years.
Because you're a designer by trade.
Yeah. So a lot of time online and on computers, and it's you don't realize how quickly it takes over every waking hour. And then just a very practical thing that I do and I advise everybody to do is don't keep your phone in your bedroom. So move it a room away so that it's not the last thing you look at night. And how many of us have sat in bed for 2 or 3 more hours after we lay down to go to bed and we're just doom scrolling or waking up first thing in the morning and we just grab it to look at the time and then 2 hours have gone by and we haven't gotten up. So just move that thing out of your room, get an old school alarm clock and take your own time and energy back so that you can step back into how do I engage with the news? Because my fear is that people totally check out and just say, I'm overwhelmed. I'm not going to watch or read the news. And we can't do that because then, you know, Donald Trump and everybody wins. They've overwhelmed us and they won.
Right. Well, one line that I loved in this chapter was, no one has ever changed their mind in the comment section on Facebook.
True.
What is your opinion on the role social media plays in political conversations?
It is a tool. It is not the town square. I think that social media is often called, you know, the digital town square. And that's what Elon talks about Twitter as being. It's not. It's a fake place. And what I've seen happen too often in, you know, even the neighborhood where I live, is people are spending all of their time on social media and thinking, oh, I've got to respond to all of these negative comments. And that's how I'm going to prove to people that they're wrong. And what they're doing is isolating themselves from their actual community. So one of the exercises in the book is, do you actually know all of your neighbors? Do you know everybody who lives within a 3-block radius of your house? Most people probably don't. That is your strongest community of influence. And if you are spending too much time on Facebook battling with your racist uncle or, you know, the people in the community page who said something upsetting or are very pro-MAGA, you're not actually engaging with your neighbors. And voting still happens in person.
Right.
Civic engagement still happens in person. It's not on Facebook. It's not online. So just take a step back. I think that the promise of social media and early Facebook particularly was to help us organize in person.
Yep.
I talk in the book about there was the nearby friends feature in Facebook that
yes.
was short-lived. Really beautiful. Like, if your friends are nearby, it will ping you so that you could actually know, oh, I'm traveling and my friend is also here, so let's go get coffee. And now it's become a place that's actually taking us away from our communities. So get off. You're not going to change your crazy uncle's mind on Facebook. You just won't. But go network your neighbors and maybe up those voting percentages in the next election.
Senator Mallory McMorrow, thank you for giving us the inside scoop on your book. And listeners, you can head to the link in our show description to buy your own copy of Hate Won't Win, Find Your Power, and Leave This Place Better Than You Found. And Mallory, you know, if you have announcements, please come back anytime. Hysteria is always happy to have you.
I will, Alyssa.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with an interview with Monica Lewinsky. Hysteria is brought to you by Manicora Honey. Are you looking for something simple and delicious to add to your wellness routine? Well, let me talk to you about the Manicora Honey. I have had a stomach issue for the past couple of months, and after doing a lot of research, decided to not even put it in my tea or shakes or salad dressings, which I had been doing, but I've been taking one teaspoon of my Manuka honey from Manicora honey 2 to 3 times a day, and it's working better than almost any prescription that I'm taking to help me with my stomach issues. It's a holistic approach. I'm also taking my medication, but it is it has really been making me feel good. It gives me energy and helps my stomach not be my main focus of the day. Manicora honey is rich, creamy, and the most delicious honey you have ever had. Take my word for it. It's ethically produced by Manicora's master beekeepers in the remote forests of New Zealand. Manicora honey contains powerful nutrients to support immunity and gut health. The bees collect the nectar from the Manuka tea tree in New Zealand. The nectar is packed with bioactives, and the honey that is produced has 3 times more antioxidants and prebiotics than your average honey. A special antibacterial compound called MGO also comes from the nectar of the tea tree. Manicora third-party tests every single harvest for MGO and makes these results available through their QR system. It's a game changer. All you need is one heaped teaspoon, as I said, each morning to get the most out of the amazing bioactives in Manuka. Additional usage throughout the day is completely fine, especially helping to cut out sweeteners. It's a honey with superpowers. And now it's easier than ever to try Manicora honey. Head to manicora.com/hysteria to get $25 off the starter kit, which comes with an MGO 850+ Manuka honey jar, 5 honey travel sticks, a wooden spoon, and a guidebook. That's Manucora.com/hysteria for $25 off your starter kit.
For a limited time, you can get a Big Mac meal for just $8. That's a burger, fries, and a drink. They don't call it an extra value meal for nothing. Get a Big Mac meal only at McDonald's.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast that knows a cake is not a cake without buttercream roses.
Exactly.
Monica Lewinsky, the world wants to tackle the manosphere, and I couldn't be happier that my new favorite podcast is yours.
Aw, thank you, honey. That means so much.
You have a podcast. Let's discuss. What made you want to talk on a microphone?
Well, I guess so. The podcast is called Reclaiming.
Yes, it is.
And I think that really was the driving force, was this idea. I had had this idea in my phone notes app for a long time around the theme of reclaiming. And I actually had been thinking that maybe I would write a book with mm-hmm. that theme and sort of what would that look like. And then it became a lot more exciting to think about talking to other people about
right.
you know, stories rather than it just being focused on me. And I wish I had listened to a lot of people 10 years ago who were telling me I should start a podcast, and I didn't listen. But, you know, so I think it's I really wanted to dive into stories with people. And I'm kind of a really curious person.
You are a curious person. Like, you're maybe one of the most curious people I know. And the beauty of your curiosity is that when of course, the minute you announced, I clicked follow, so you're in my feed. But when I went to the just main screen of Apple, girl, your podcast was like top 10 overall.
Aww.
Yes,
aww,
ma'am.
That's nice.
I know. I just need everybody to know because everyone should be following. Okay. So we had talked last summer. You were talking to me about you were thinking of a podcast. You didn't say reclaiming. Yes. So how'd you pull the trigger? How did it come together?
Well, I guess it was last year at some point or the end of 2023. I had made this decision. I wrote up a pitch over the holidays and started, you know, that sort of process, like everything where you think, oh, this will be done in 5 minutes. And instead, 5 months later, you kind of end up in the right home and met with different. I feel like this is a very detailed answer. You know,
I love super detailed.
Oh my gosh, there was this great meme this morning on Instagram that it's like, my intention of telling a story, the straight freeway, and how it really looks of, you know, just kind of all the things. So to go back to it, I think for me, it was meeting with different outlets mm-hmm. who produce podcasts, talking to them about this vision I had of having these kinds of open conversations with people who are both well-known to us and people whose names we know less, but whose stories are just as interesting. Mm-hmm. So, and sort of both weaving in my own story, my own experience of reclaiming my narrative with all the elastic ways that people experience reclaiming. Because it's a really universal experience.
It is. It's like when I listen to your podcast, I'm like, and we'll get to this, but you always ask people, what are they reclaiming? And I'm like, I am fully in the throes of perimenopause. And I'm like, I'm reclaiming my body. Like it is, I have felt out of control and it hurt my mental health so much to feel so out of control that I do feel now like I am reclaiming my body. Like I am taking the steps. I'm like, this is what I'm doing. So your podcast made me think about what I am reclaiming.
Good. But yeah, it's perimenopause. It's real. I feel so lucky that Gen X, that we're sort of getting go through this in a way that's different than the older generations where nobody talked about it. It was that silent sin.
It feels very like I feel grateful because mm-hmm. we are so adjacent. Women who we see as our own age, right? People who are just like 10 years older than me, who did not have any of these sort of the accoutrements, some of the medications that we have.
Even talking about perimenopause, like even the term perimenopause was, you know, something that I think was new. And so then when you start to put the math together of like, oh, that time that I flew off the handle and went from 0 to 60 in 30 seconds. Oh, all my brain fog. Oh, my aches and pains. It like that's what it's about, you know.
It is. So I'm reclaiming. And so here, okay, next question. As someone, and I couldn't be more interested in your answer to this. So as someone who's been telling her story either against her will or on her own terms in recent years, how did you adapt or take charge of being the person who is asking the question?
I think my approach is actually really informed by my own experiences of both the times that I have felt really safe and comfortable having I feel mm-hmm. super safe and comfortable right now with you, Alyss, and I even know that if you ask me something that made me feel uncomfortable, I know the intention is not that.
Right.
You know? And so I think that is in part a guiding force. And I think wanting people to feel comfortable, wanting them to feel safe, mm-hmm. To have these sort of open discussions, because to me, off the microphone, off camera, the most magic that happens between people is when you find that place of vulnerability and openness and discussion and sharing and that sort of the me too, me too, me too, me too. And you also, you know, bring your own perspectives, but then you start to unpack your perspectives and think about things differently too, which is really interesting. You know, I've loved that. Like so many of the conversations I've had so far, you know, I walk away thinking that I hadn't thought about it that way.
Right.
You know, so Yeah.
I think it's been great. What is so interesting too is that you are someone, you're like pretty methodical with your outward presentation. You know, that is to say that like you try to think 10 steps ahead of what you're about to say before you say it. You know, you try to navigate and protect yourself against bloopers, unintended puns. And so, like, you tell a great story about your TEDx talk and the microphone. And so now that you're the interviewer, how does that work for you? Or have you overcome it? Are you looser? But, like, as the interviewer, you're moving at a clip most of the time. So how do you resolve that? Or do you just work around it?
Well, I'm a work in progress. So, I mean, I think I can already feel how much more comfortable. I think we just did my 13th interview yesterday.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so I already can see that I'm feeling more comfortable trusting my own instincts, trusting what I share. I think I've been super sensitive to, without naming names, there's sometimes podcasts I've listened to where the host is a well-known person and I feel like they're talking too much and they're not letting their guests talk a lot. So I that's my constant fear. You know, I'll say to the team after, I was like, did I talk too much? You know, is this, I just don't want to, I don't want to overshadow the conversation or the guest stories. So it's,
you know what I would tell you?
What?
I would tell you that I think you're a little too self-conscious about talking too much and that would be my little bit of feedback on your podcast. I can tell there are parts in the interview where I can tell you have something to say and you sort of speed through your personal opinion because you want everyone else to speak so much and we want to hear from you too. So you're not speaking too much.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
I'll try and remember that.
Okay. so you know, because I was texting you, I loved your interview with Kara Swisher.
Like, thank you.
I find her to be one of the smartest people out there. I am so deeply intimidated by her that when I saw you had her on, I was like, brave.
Can I show off for a second?
Yes, please.
She was my second interview.
Yes.
So that was the second one I conducted. And Kara, have you met Kara?
No, because I'm intimidated. I'm intimidated by her.
You two need to know each other. You need to.
Brooke is our connection, right? You and Brooke.
Exactly.
You and Brooke Hammerling, our friends, are our connection.
Exactly. And so we need to have dinner with Brooke, even though usually Kara, Brooke, and myself, I'm like, Charlie's Angels, you can be, we'll have a fourth. And you can
Be the mascot, okay? I can just be the mascot. But she, like, so what is so interesting? So I have a two-part question. So I listened to the interview with Kara, who I listen to, she's my must-listen next to you now. Every week I listen to both of her podcasts. And I always learn so much from her, which is why I love her podcast. And it's not too political. I love learning about the business of it all. But so I listened to Kara, and then I listened to your, because I listen out of order, then I listened to your interview with Olivia Munn and talk about her cancer diagnosis, which was actually so moving. I sat down in Hudson River Park and just, like, finished the whole episode because I didn't want to, like, pause it. So, so this is how I feel, though. I feel like you put a lot of effort into the podcast. Like, do you do a lot of research? Do you get nervous? And also, how do you approach interviews with friends?
Yes.
Because like you and Olivia are friends, you and Kara are now friends, so I'm curious about that.
Okay, so first of all, I do an enormous amount of prep and research. I'm also incredibly lucky to have a brilliant team that helps me. So I'm not doing everything myself. I'm metabolizing what I'm getting. I'm sometimes doing additional research. I'm talking things out with the other producers, hearing different ideas. You know, I have an interview tomorrow and I was like, okay, this is the angle I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
And just sort of gut check or might say, okay, here are my own personal stories that came up as I was thinking about this. Does this feel resonant to someone or does this feel cuckoo?
Right.
And so there's that part of it. Do an enormous amount of prep. I still get nervous. The sweating that happens.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the day that I finish, you know, conducting an interview on the podcast. And I'm like, oh, I could actually, you know, sit next to somebody else and they would not die from my stink. Okay, awesome. So there's still the nervousness there. But I am feeling a lot more comfortable and I'm trying to trust my instincts more. And, you know, and I think one of the things about just even the name reclaiming is that it's also my own reclaiming. This is my own, you know, of finding my voice again in a different way, in a public way, in finding more of a identity as in a career too.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So so it's all those things. And then how do I deal with friends, which is I'm very mindful, you know, in the same way that you are, right? I think I'm very mindful of like, okay, if I thought an area was sensitive to someone, I would ask them ahead of time.
Right.
You know, just like, do you feel comfortable talking about this? You know, or I might say if I, because not everything is, you know, like written out before you do it, obviously. And so I think that if something came up in the course of the discussion, I might phrase something of, you know, if you feel comfortable sharing about this, like if you want to talk about this and give somebody an opportunity. And I think they know if I ask a question and they say they don't want to talk about it, it will be on the cutting room floor.
Totally. You
know? Because, I mean, you know this, right?
I've been doing this for 6 years. I still prep like a maniac. And a couple months ago, it was like September, I got to interview Speaker Pelosi. And I was so,
How did I miss that?
I will send it to you. Yeah. I was so nervous because she is, to me, she is like the elected version of Kara Swisher. Like she knows everything. There is nothing like you don't want to ask trite questions. You don't, you want to ask sort of revealing questions, but then you don't want her to be like, you also know she's coming with a purpose. And I'll tell you, it was like an hour before the interview and I was with one of our friends at Crooked and I was like, I'm sorry, I need a half a glass of wine. I need to take it from a 10 down to a 5. I was sweating. Yes, yeah. I was sweating and I was like, so even 6 years later, I am still, and even for you, getting ready for today, you are my friend. We have known each other for years. And I still was like, you know what? I'm going to do even more than just have listened to her podcast, which we'll get to in a little bit. We're going to get into some things I have read. But here's an interesting, so here's what I want to know. Sky's the limit. I can imagine, I can think that anybody who would want to be on your podcast will be on your podcast. Who is a dream guest?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. And it's funny because I realized after the launch that, that sometimes when you're a public person and you say another public like you want another public person on your thing, it becomes a thing. And I was like, oh God.
It's a good point.
You know, so I don't want to, like there is a woman that you know very well for whom you worked in that administration that I just would love to talk to and think I would love to talk to Michelle Obama. You know, that's like you said, pie in the sky. So I think she would be an extraordinary person to talk to in so many different ways. But Taylor Swift is another one.
Oh, of course.
So. Okay. Right, I know. Like,
I mean, 10-minute version.
I know. I mean, the other person that we've sort of gone after, and not surprisingly, have yet to hear a response, just given how elusive they are, is Banksy. So I'd be super interested to talk to Banksy.
Okay, these are good.
I mean, it just. Well, the thing too is that, and what's interesting to me about Taylor Swift, and when I was pitching the show and I talk about the show, I think when I say the words, like it's an elastic definition of reclaiming, you kind of go, oh, okay. But when I say, I want to talk to Taylor Swift about Taylor's versions, then you sort of start to see that this is more than just a comeback story.
Right.
That you know, comeback stories are great, but it's not so much a hero's journey in a sense of like, it's this very contained thing.
Yeah.
There are bajillions of reclaiming stories that are out there. And I want to hear all of them. So it's
we're all here for it. I don't know if this falls into the bucket of reclaiming, but you have another project in the works, not a podcast, but it's with Amanda Knox. Mm-hmm. What are you allowed to tell us about your Amanda Knox project?
Well, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this or not, but we're in a phase of watching watching things, watching episodes, and in nascent stages. And I fucking sobbed this morning. I bawled. And I know that some of that for me comes from the crossovers of my own experiences.
Sure.
Even though they're vastly different, you know, mm-hmm. DC, Perugia, I didn't go to jail, Amanda did. I mean, there's right. so many different things, right? But there's this underpinning that is around the societal story. Mm-hmm. And so, and that kind of, and I know you know this, not from the experience, not from maybe your own personal narrative experience, but from having been the youngest assistant chief of staff.
Assistant to the president, deputy I've been gone. Chief of staff. That's so good.
Right. Sorry. Look how long I've been gone from D.C. I forgot all the fucking names. But I mean, you have had such a unique place in the world of how you've been able to see the world and what's come mm-hmm. across your perspective. So I know you understand this around stories, but these stories that are collective that happen, these widespread global stories I just kind of each step of the way, I keep getting more and more excited for the world to see this. And
it's a scripted show.
Scripted dramatic show.
Scripted dramatic
on
show.
Hulu.
On Hulu.
Right.
Coming in 2024, 2025. Oh, it is 2025.
Oh, 25, I know.
25, 26.
Actually, it's going to be 2020. So
okay. Oh, even better.
That I cannot say yet.
Okay,
so.
Fine.
But I hope that it lands with people in the way that it's been landing with me.
And especially when you watch something that you've been so integrally a part of, you know, you just, because this has been years in the making.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I feel, I mean, I know you've had this experience too as an executive producer, and it's very interesting to get to go inside an industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and so I think like me, you've had this experience inside the world of politics. You've had this experience inside the world of entertainment, inside the world of media. And I feel so grateful for that. You know,
I do. It's funny. I do. It is a thing that, you know, from... I always joke with young people who ever ask for quote unquote career advice that when I was their age, I didn't know that any single job I would end up having even existed.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah. No.
Like at all.
No one asked me for career advice. So, but it's true. It's like, it just, there are all these worlds, but those, it's funny. What comes up for me is I remember when I was in college and I was a psychology major, and, in one of our classes, the teacher was talking about, or did someone come in and talk about it? I can't even remember that part now. I just remember the moment in the, it wasn't personality theory. So it was like, it was a class that was about how psychological instruments are devised.
Yeah.
And so, and all these different tests and things. And I just became super fascinated with this idea of being able to kind of almost codify what seems like irrational behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you could somehow take all these people from different walks of life, give them a test, and it'll give you this information in a way that is, you know, meaningful. And so that led me to want to do, you know, that and Silence of the Lambs, like led me to want to do testing, you know, to do testing at the FBI. To like,
wow.
Yeah,
that is not where I thought you were going with Silence of the Lambs. I thought I was going to have to tell like how impacted I was by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's speech when they won Best Screenplay for Good Will Hunting. I'm like, you want to be a profiler. I get it.
Exactly. I'm like, I wanted to come to understand psychos.
Have you?
You're pretty good. I don't know.
Well, I can't wait to see the Amanda Knox project because we were both at 20th mm-hmm. Studios. So we know how long it takes for things to see the light of day in Hollywood. And I cannot wait. It will be – I will binge it like I binged The Pit.
Somebody was saying just last night how amazing that is.
Oh,
but also,
Monica.
Too, I want to shout out for you.
What?
If anybody hasn't seen the Brooke Shields documentary.
Oh,
I can't
thank
remember
you.
What it's called. What's
Pretty
it called
Baby
properly?
Brooke Shields.
That's right. That is – extraordinary.
That was, and the first time we watched it, we all cried. The first time we saw the rough cut. And then, you know, you just, and then it goes out into the world and you're like, oh my God. Yeah. I can do so many different things. You can do so many different things. Right. But you know what you can't do? Segway. You can't cook, can you?
No. I make a few things, and the few things that I make are, you know, you would still be friends with me after if I fed them to you.
Okay.
But by and large, no.
So this is why I know that you are not a cooker, like a real one. And so that's why I died when I opened up New York Magazine and your 5-day food diary is there in Grub Street. And I'm like, what is Monica doing talking about food? And then I read it and I howled with laughter. So we're going to ask some questions.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. You love ice cream, but specific ice cream. What kind of ice cream do you like?
Peanut butter and chocolate from Baskin-Robbins.
Which I died because I think Baskin-Robbins is the most Gen X ice cream brand. Like we predate Ben & Jerry's. Like,
oh, yeah.
Baskin-Robbins was when my sister and I, and my sister always listens to the pod, so sis, you'll know, we would go to Olin Mills to get our pictures taken, and then we'd get Baskin-Robbins, and my flavor was Jamocha almond fudge.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was never really, because I felt like, oh, the almonds, that's too healthy. That
Fair
shouldn't
enough.
Be in ice cream. But
I still love it. I still love it.
Oh, yeah.
It's my favorite.
I will always, I'd like to say I'm so busy that I justify the DoorDash, but also PS hashtag slash lazy. I will DoorDash Baskin Robbins. And so it's a heartbreak for me when at the market they're out of peanut butter and chocolate in the little pints. But I think too, I mean, I know families still do this, but it was like that was the treat. The treat was to sort of go to Baskin-Robbins after, you know, so.
And you got to see what flavors, because they didn't always have all 31 flavors.
Exactly.
And so
you could try them with a little pink spoon, you know.
It was the greatest. I still, there's a Baskin-Robbins in Manhattan, and I will go to it every now and again when I am here. Because also the mint chocolate chip.
Yeah, mint. The mint chocolate chip is really good in the cake. Cousin, he was a mint chocolate chip cake, birthday cake person.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, that's really good too. So with the frozen frosting.
You know what? You know what we're going to do next year to celebrate Amanda Knox whenever she comes out? We're going to get a Baskin-Robbins cake and I'll put buttercream roses on it.
Oh, yeah.
And we will eat the whole thing.
I know. Or when I have you on the pod.
I'll
bring you if we
either
do,
way.
I'd like to do them in person. So when you come on Reclaiming.
We'll talk about when I'm going to be in LA. I have a little lightning round for you.
Okay.
All right. You ready?
Yeah.
Thing you're most looking forward to about spring, even though you live in California?
The hummingbirds. There's so many hummingbirds that come out.
Really?
I love hummingbirds. They're just magical creatures.
Okay, so. I have to agree about the birds. I can hear them chirping. Mm-hmm. They're coming back. I love it. Okay, favorite treat.
Ooh. I would say I have kind of been on a Butterfingers kick.
Delicious.
So,
My candy bar treat is a whatchamacallit.
Oh, I love a whatchamacallit. I mean, my normal go-to is the ice cream and cupcakes, and when I, you know, one of the many, many things I make are Rice Krispie treats. So
I'm a really good
Rice Krispie treat maker.
See, but I feel like you're like me. I mostly live alone, and so because my husband works in the city, and I'm usually upstate, and so it's like if I make myself a treat, I need to know exactly who I'm foisting at least 50% of them off on, because I can't have them all alone in my. It's like too much. Because I'll eat them all. Okay, what show are you binging?
The White Lotus, everybody else in the world.
Yeah, this week's episode was a lot to handle.
Yeah, it was a lot. I have like multiple people that I'm sort of going, okay. I have one friend who was sort of saying, okay, could you watch it already? Could you watch it already? And so we can have the discussion and the whole thing. So
where would you most like to see the next White Lotus set?
Okay, this is kind of crazy, but I feel like a Disneyland resort, that I just think there could be something really interesting there.
That would be Amazing. That is the best. That is the best suggestion I have heard yet. I think that would be, I want them to stay at the Polynesian and something to happen on the monorail. Okay. All right. 10 out of 10. I hope Mike White is listening because that would be great.
Exactly.
Okay. Book on your nightstand that you haven't read yet.
Okay. So the truth is, like, at night, I'm a Kindle reader.
Okay.
So
fair.
I don't really know what the next, I have a whole stack of real books that I consider. And then I feel like my read before I go to bed books or usually
sleep?
Regency era
Can you sleep and
novels.
Read your, oh, see, yeah, romance is always good. Do you, you can read a Kindle and still fall asleep?
Yeah. I have like a sleep mask and I have a whole thing. I've like trained myself to it's, you know, roll over, throw the Kindle, pull the mask down, you know.
And you're done.
Or I'd say maybe 1/10 of the time. I'm reawakened by the noise of the Kindle falling on the floor. So,
that happens to me with my phone. Okay, so here's my last question.
Okay,
what would 80-year-old Monica tell 50-year-old Monica?
Oh gosh, I think probably two things: of stop worrying so much. You know, and the miracles haven't stopped. So get ready, you know, more miracles. Okay.
I love that. We're all here for more miracles. Monica Lewinsky, your new pod, Reclaiming, is out anywhere you listen to your pods. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back for Sani Petty with Senator McMorrow. Hysteria is brought to you by Babbel. You say you'll learn a new language every year, but few of us actually commit to it. Babbel makes it easy for you to learn one in less time than you think. Now, I love learning new languages. I was raised to believe that we should not be just English-centric, that if we want to be good global citizens, we should be able to go to other countries and speak other languages. So I actually took French for 12 years. Took Japanese. I can speak a little Japanese. And my mom and her family speak German. And so I have actually been trying to brush up on my German with my Babbel. And it is going great. And I test it with my mom, who is a very, she's a critic. Let's just put it that way. This year, speak like a whole new you with Babbel, the language learning app that gets you talking. Learning a new language is the pathway to discovering new cultures, so why not embark on learning something new? Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons, handcrafted by over 200 language experts, get you to begin speaking your new language in 3 weeks or whatever pace you choose. And because conversing is the key to really understanding each other in new languages, Babbel is designed using practical, real-world conversations. Spending months with private teachers is the old way of learning languages, and nothing screams tourist like holding a phone translation app up to your face all day. Worse, if you can't even use the translation app. Babbel's tips and tools are inspired by the real-life stuff you actually need when communicating. With a focus on conversation, you'll be ready to talk wherever you go. So like I said, I am working on my German and also brushing up on my Japanese because I think my husband and I are going to go to Japan next year. And let's just say, totemo ii desu ne. Need proof that Babbel gets you talking? Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and other leading universities continue to prove Babbel works. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. With over 16 million subscriptions sold, Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. This year, get talking with Babbel. Let's get more of you talking in a new language. Babbel is gifting our listeners 60% off subscriptions at babbel.com/hysteria. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/hysteria, spelled BABBEL.com/hysteria. Babbel.com/hysteria. Rules and restrictions may apply.
For a limited time, you can get a Big Mac meal for just $8. That's a burger, fries, and a drink. They don't call it an extra value meal for nothing. Get a Big Mac meal only at McDonald's.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
Welcome back to Hysteria, the podcast that is confused and scared and also entertained by Ivanka Trump's jujitsu videos. First, some announcements for the class. Hey, Hysteria listeners, if you love true crime, check out Shadow Kingdom God's Banker. In 1982, Vatican banker Roberto Calvi was found hanging under a London bridge. Suicide? That's the official story, but the truth is far murkier. Episode 3 drops today, and in it, a raid on an Italian warehouse exposes a secret far-right society, topples Italy's government, and leaves Calvi scrambling to survive. Listen to Shadow Kingdom, God's Banker, wherever you get your podcasts, or binge all episodes now at crooked.com/friends or on the Shadow Kingdom Apple Podcasts feed. Now, let's get to Sani Petty. Mallory, are you feeling Sani or Petty today?
I'm feeling Sani. You know, I'm feeling Sani. All of the horrible signal gate news, and I'm feeling Sani.
Okay, well, I'm feeling Petty, so I'm going to go first so we can leave everybody with a better taste in their mouth. I have, since Trump became president, and I say that like it's been a year when it's been 8.5 weeks or some shit like that, I have tried to leave politics out of Sani Petty, but something got me so torqued up that I have to share. So you probably saw, and there have been iterations of this story. There's been breaking news just this morning that I believe in politics, you leave the first lady and the family out of things. They did not ask for this in most instances, you know, and having lived with Michelle, I knew Michelle Obama for years, a year, 2 years, however long it was, before we ran for president. I knew how she felt about the safety and the privacy of she and the girls. So And I saw how, like, Laura Bush lived as first lady, and she always put Jen and Barbara first. And, like, being friends with Barbara now, I know that that was actually the truth and how much they put family first. So when I saw the when Usha Vance became second lady and they have three small kids, I was like, everybody leave Usha alone. Leave her name out of your mouth. Like, just stop. Then I saw the breaking news that Usha had agreed to go to Greenland. And I just felt like it's such a wreck. I'm like, girl, what are you doing? Don't do this. When you are in administration, the first foreign trips you take are significant. They send a message. They signal your priorities. And she was going, and it seemed like, by all accounts, that this was not coordinated. Also, huge issue. When you are in the White House, your trips are coordinated through the embassies with the foreign country. They're notified. They help you plan your trip. Like, it is a thing. And it seemed that Greenland was like, why are you coming? We don't want you. What are you doing? She said she was going to go as, like, a cultural ambassador, and she was going to see the dog sled races. And they were like, don't do that. And then I see last night that JD is like, he puts out a video and he's like, I couldn't let Usha have all the fun. And so I'm going to go too. And I'm like, why are you guys doing this? They're using taxpayer money. And by the way, foreign trips are usually for either settling problems or diplomacy. This is neither. And the American taxpayers are going to pay for his weird ass trip to Greenland, which, funny enough, again, this was like the third paragraph in the story that I read this morning, that the Americans have actually sort of capitulated, that Greenland was like, get out of here. They had so there are only 56,000 people who live on Greenland, and 1,000 of them came out last week and were like, America, stop. We don't want you. They started protesting against Trump. And so anyway, now the trip is down. It's a totally different thing. They're going to the part of Greenland that is sort of occupied, is semi-autonomous by Denmark. And I mean, I don't know. It's just like, why do we have to, like, live through this? And Trump says he wants to do what's best for Greenland, as if they don't know. And we just know that that means he wants their minerals and resources. And Usha, why did you have to do this? I was willing to give you the benefit of the doubt forever.
Yeah, now you're part of it. Now you're in.
She's part of it. It's like in for a dime, in for a dollar. But I don't know who convinced her. I always want to think, I don't know why, I always want to think that the women are not, like, even at the beginning of Trump in 2017, whenever it was, I was like, Melania, girl. And then she wore that jacket that's like, I don't care to you, right? And I was like, okay, forget you now too. Because I was like, back then, Barron was young. And I was like, I don't know, maybe she hates him. I don't know. But so anyway, Usha, I wanted to give you the benefit of the doubt. Now I kind of can't. Now you're the same as all the rest. And I feel bad about that. So anyway, Mallory, what are you feeling sane about? What's giving you sanity?
I am feeling sane about community. And I'm going to tell you why. Okay. So my daughter is 4 now. And when she was growing up, her favorite thing to watch on TV was Olympic track and field, weirdly. She loved the runner ladies. And because they were the little bloomers, she would run around the house in her diaper and like throw her body onto the couch like she was a high jumper. And it was the cutest thing. So she has always wanted to go to what she calls a running festival. So like a 5K is a running festival. And I signed her up for one in Corktown, part of Detroit, has a kids' quarter mile. And she came out and she was so excited. She couldn't sleep the night before. She got her like custom shirt, but because she's 4, I got an extra small and I still had to tie a little knot on it so it wasn't a dress and she didn't trip on it. And she wore a tutu and she and I ran. And just seeing like all these moms and dads and kids, and we're all running in Detroit around Michigan Central, the train station that was just renovated and reopened. It's beautiful. So we're running this quarter mile and she's moving her little legs as fast as she can. And she got a medal, and everybody she saw all the way walking back to the car, she gave everybody a high five.
Stop.
And she congratulated them, and she told them, I'm a Corktown runner. And then she wore her medal for 3 days straight. And it was just such a nice break
from
all of this chaos to get together. And kids just want to run. They just want to get out there.
Kids just want to run. But also there's something so fun about seeing the potential in small people. Like my niece loves to play soccer, and I will go to her soccer practice sometimes. And I'm like, when she was real small, I got her like a little baby Megan Rapinoe onesie.
Oh, I love it.
Because I'm like, who knows? Sky's the limit for these kids. Maybe they're going to be runners. Maybe they're going to be on the World Cup. It's like, and everyone came out. That's so lovely.
It was just lovely. And it was the first, St. Patrick's Day in Detroit is usually just miserable. It's like cold and rainy and horrible. But the sun came out and it was just, we needed it. It restored my faith in humanity and in decency and in all of these people just like coming out and hanging out and high-fiving all the kids. So cute.
Well, I'm going to be such a nerd because, Mallory, talking to leaders like you restores my faith. So thank you for co-hosting today. And thank you so much to Monica Lewinsky for joining us. And thank you, listeners. We'll be back with Hysteria next week.
Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on IG, Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusives like This Fucking Guy, our video series. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Claire Fogarty is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seguin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Gajewski and Claudia Sheng. And thank you to Daisy Cruz and David Tolles for production and marketing support every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting.
Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.